101.1 FM KFUG Crescent City.
I light the fire. You place the flowers in the vase that you bought today.
You are listening to New Culture Radio. I am your host, Dan Schultz, and I am very happy to have back James Corbett, who, if you don't know his work at CorbettReport.com, I have spoken about it before. It is one of, if not my favorite, news source. I like the way he delivers the news. I like his research. It's open source. He has show notes. You can research the subjects for yourself. If you only used one news source, if you could only use one, you could do worse for the Corbett Report. I'm really thankful for it. Welcome to the show, James.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for that nice introduction. It's a pleasure to be talking to you again, Dan.
Yeah, I love your stuff. It's so thorough and so well done. I'm really happy to have you because I have some very specific questions that I've been wanting your take on. And unfortunately, I don't get to hear every single podcast that you do. And so I want to delve in first with an economic question, a few economic questions. And this after I just listened to your podcast about the Shemitah, which I'm really happy that you have the position that you do, that, you know, these predictive cycles are not all they're cracked up to be. And I'm not asking for a prediction from you, but I'd like to get your take on some of the meanings, like the so-called alleged in July, the glitch, the internal technical issue that halted trading on the New York Stock Exchange and the United Airlines shutdown and the Wall Street Journal. What did you make out of that incident?
Well, I guess there are a few different ways of looking at it. One is that even if we were to take these stories at face value, they show the fundamental instability in these systems that we are relying on to facilitate smooth transactions in the market. So at the very least, we have to say that these people are incompetent in actually running the system. Although I think you're right to ask if there's anything more behind incidents like these. So not only the glitch that suspended trading, for example, back a couple of months ago, but we can look at the flash crash, obviously, of 2010, which they have now officially basically pinned the blame on one guy, one day trader who was living in his parents' house in Hounslow, just outside of London, I guess. And apparently they're trying to prosecute this one man for single-handedly bringing about the flash crash back in 2010, where the markets dropped hundreds of points in a matter of seconds. Of course, I think we all know that that's a load of baloney and that they're just trying to cover it up and blaming it on a single person in the same way they might blame a trading suspension glitch on some sort of, you know, computer system problem. Whereas I think the problems are much more deeper and fundamental. And to begin even parsing what could possibly be behind things like this, we have to look into things like the high frequency trading, which has basically come to dominate the markets in recent years in ways that most people, I think, have no appreciation of. Your average mom and pop trader don't really understand. They're not competing against other traders. They're competing against algorithms, proprietary algorithms programmed by the Goldman Sachs employees of the world and people in the big banking houses who can afford programmers to do nothing other than to devise algorithms to make trades on fractions of a fraction of a second, talking about microsecond trades going on here, to follow the markets, to pump and prime the markets to in order to put themselves into a better trading position and things like this, which, as we know, can cause mayhem like what we saw during the flash crash in 2010. So I think we have to start looking at things like that when we look at some of these technical glitches that suspend trading to realize that that's just one of the many ways that these markets are not at all what they seem to be. And unfortunately, again, I think the biggest problem with this is that most people have no idea that this is going on, so that they'll just take and swallow stories like this pretty much at face value. And again, I think that's just another sign that the markets are much more manipulated than people realize. And I think it's all that much more dangerous because people don't seem to realize that this is going on behind the scenes. So I know that's an inadequate response, because again, we are on the outside looking in, and we can get certain details, but I think that ultimately events like that are only going to be fully known to the insiders participating in them. But I definitely think that there's more going on than just the computer glitches themselves. But even that narrative allows for the creation of a wider narrative that, because of cybersecurity, we have to make sure that there aren't terrorists who can do things like crash the markets by seizing up the New York Stock Exchange or things of that nature. And that's just another part of the sort of growing cybersecurity narrative. So it plays into stories like that as well. So I think it's very conceivable that, although I don't have any particular reason to believe that any of these previous incidents have been any type of false flag event, we certainly could see some sort of virtual false flag event with a seize up of, for example, the New York Stock Exchange or something along those lines, and then blame it on whoever the enemy of the week is, China or whatever boogeyman people want to blame it on, Iran maybe, and use that as an excuse to go to war. I think that is a definite possibility and something that we have to be wary of, because once we enter this realm where everything that's taking place is taking place on servers, we don't have access to the server logs, they just come out and say, guess what, Iran attacked us, now we have to go to war. I think we have to be very wary of that that possibility as we go on from this point.
Yeah, have you gotten to the point that I have where if the government says it, I don't know what the percentage is, but I'm just going to give it a 99%, that it's probably a lie or there's some other story behind it, that everything is spun, that you never, I mean, maybe there are some raw numbers that they come out with. Those are increasingly fudged, but almost everything that the government says is a lie.
Yes. And I think the lie aspect of it is not necessarily in the specific details, but as you say, in the context, the way the story is spun. That's always, I think, the most important part, because you'll find even in the mainstream media, they will report on a lot of things that actually, I mean, amazingly, you wouldn't expect them to report on, but they often do. It's usually in passing, and it's always in a contextless manner. So they never tell you what the significance of this story is, or why we should be, why it's more important than what they're saying. For example, something like the LIBOR case that broke a year or two ago now, the biggest financial fraud in the history of humanity, the London Interbank Offered Rate being the basis for literally, depending how you calculate it, I've heard as much as hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of assets are calculated based on this LIBOR rate that was being manipulated. We know it was being manipulated. So that story was reported on, and there's still occasional updates talking about this or that trader getting thrown under the bus for it, but nowhere near the type of coverage you would expect for the largest systemic financial fraud in the history of the human species. I mean, that's pretty amazing, but again, it just goes to show it's the context that matters and the way it's framed and when what they choose to focus on, so that they'll focus on shooting a lion in Africa much more than they'll focus on something like that. So again, I think it's lying not just by direct lying, but lying by omission and lying by spin and things of that nature. But we also have to worry about just automatically knee-jerk assuming that anything we hear is a lie, because then, I mean, obviously, the people who puppeteer this information are not stupid. They know that if they can get you to believe that everything they say is a lie, then they'll tell you the truth in order for you to be confused once again. So I think, like anything else that we hear by anyone, alternative media, mainstream media, government official, whoever it is, we have to check the sources. We have to check it out for ourselves. I think there's no shortcut to knowing whether something is true or not, other than doing the legwork and actually finding out via the research.
In the spirit of not believing everything you hear, and even in the spirit of this information overload where we understand that everything is a lie or it's spun, we understand that the media is controlled. Even understanding this system of propaganda, maybe on another level, after listening to your Shmita podcast, do you believe that the powers that be, whether you call them the Illuminati or the Bilderbergs or the shadow government or however it is, do you believe they provide warnings or signals for events that they precipitate? Some people do. I mean, like I saw the Simpsons had a you know, Bart Simpson with 9/11 in the Twin Towers before 9/11 happened. I don't actually know that that's true. I just saw it. I didn't back it up, but I've heard a number of people talk about how they have this code of ethics where they have to tell us what's going to happen before they do it to us.
Well, I would be wary about totalizing narratives like that, because, again, I don't even think that the people that are puppeteering the system are one homogenous group and they're all on the same page. I think there's internal squabbles between different groups and things like that. So I think that when it comes to major events, yes, I could imagine certainly that they will telegraph certain things for people in the know to know, you know, for example, this is the time to get out of the markets or things like that. I could see that. And we have seen a lot of things that, again, in retrospect, you can look at a lot of the clues that have been embedded in media about 9/11 that sometimes are just head scratching. I mean, did the prop master on The Matrix know that the expiry date of Neo's passport, 9/11/2001, was the date that was going to happen? Well, obviously not. So how did that actually get put in there, and by whom? And, you know, I mean, that kind of thing is just really mind-boggling to contemplate. But then, unfortunately, we also have this kind of pet industry that's propped up, that's come up in recent years, trying to look for these types of clues and making all sorts of predictions based on it. So you bring up, for example, I think now the pretty infamous 9/11 Bart, was it Bart or Lisa, holds up a magazine for just a second. It's only on screen for a second or so, and it's the big $9 to go to New York or something, and then the Twin Towers make up kind of the 11, 9/11. That's an interesting little image. I don't think it necessarily means that was a telegraphed event. But anyway, it's something that we can talk about. But unfortunately, then you get people scrying the tea leaves of The Simpsons, assuming that everything that ever appears on the screen is going to tell us about the event, the next date of the next event. So in a recent article I did about the Shemitah, I pointed to a 2010 prophecy. There's going to be a false flag nuclear event in November of 2010, and they used as the basis of that a screenshot from a Simpsons episode where, I don't know, some clock falls from the sky near Homer or something, and the clock's pointing to the numbers 11 and 6, and somehow, whatever, through whatever means, people came up with, oh, this means there's going to be a nuclear false flag event in November 2010. Of course there wasn't, but amazingly, that wasn't the end of it. The exact same image was later used to predict a false flag event in 2012. So, I mean, we can see this can become a very not just a fruitless activity, but an actually detrimental activity. If people start taking it to this level and looking for all these clues, trying to find, you know, what's going to be the next event. And I've literally seen dozens and dozens and dozens of such predictions based on, oh, look at this, you know, movie, and, you know, they show us a number on the screen for two seconds, and that clearly means there's going to be this type of... I mean, I've seen dozens of those types of analyses over the years, not even looking for them, and every single one of them has been wrong, trying to predict the next false flag event. So I think that, yes, I mean, I do see that this can be used, and sometimes I'm sure actually is used, but again, it's one of those things that I don't think it has any predictive value, because there's a lot of garbage information out there too that we can spend our time chasing our tails trying to look for the trace of the Illuminati rather than, you know, actually doing what we need to do anyway, regardless. And that was ultimately the point of my take on the Shemitah and all the hype and panic about this. Yes, there is. I mean, there are fundamental instabilities in the monetary order right now. There are huge changes coming. The U.S. dollar is going to lose its status as world reserve currency. There are going to be tsunamis of financial disaster coming in the future for people who aren't prepared for it. So let's get prepared for it. And let's stop, you know, worrying, wringing our hands, whether it's, you know, September 15th or September 23rd or October or, you know, 2017 or 2022 or whenever it's going to happen. Let's just do what we need to do to get prepared for these things now and stop worrying about predicting the precise date on which it's going to happen.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And circling back to what you were talking about, Hollywood and finding signs in movies, I agree with you that we can get lost in that. I'm curious about the history of Hollywood being in bed with government. And I've heard people talk about how even the Hunger Games is a psyop. And I haven't had a television for many years, James, but I rent movies and I go to the theater. And increasingly, I think I'm picking up on, I mean, not only do I see obviously all of the product placement, the corporate influence on Hollywood films all over the place, but I'm also picking up on what I think are government messages or the powers that be conditioning us. Do you believe that Hollywood is a big psyop, or to what degree do you think that's the case?
Yes, yes. It's not a question of whether it's the case. It's just a question of what, to what degree. And although I'm sure there are pieces of entertainment that really aren't necessarily there as some sort of deliberate psyop, there demonstrably are pieces of information and pieces of entertainment and Hollywood movies that are absolutely designed to shape people's perceptions and understanding of the world. And we can tell this from such things as, I mean, there's been a lot of reporting about Pentagon and Pentagon cooperation with Hollywood on various movies, and whether they will or will not cooperate with a movie usually is determined by whether or not that movie will change certain plot points or to be in more in line with the message that the U.S. military wants to convey. That's a well-documented phenomenon going back, of course, decades and decades, and that link has been well established. But also, perhaps less well known, but hopefully becoming more well known, is the fact that the CIA has a close relationship with Hollywood. In fact, the CIA actually has an entertainment industry liaison, and you can go to the CIA website, CIA.gov, and they have a whole section talking about the entertainment industry liaison and the work that they do. Of course, making it sound like it's such a wonderful thing that, you know, trying to represent the American intelligence community in the best possible light. But of course, they do cooperate on numerous films, and you can look at some of the ones that they have cooperated on in the past and the way it's shaped our perception of various events. I mean, even something like Enemy of the State, which came out in the 1990s, and it was Will Smith and Gene Hackman, I want to say, you know, basically in a kind of NSA is watching everything spy drama thriller that basically in many ways sort of let a lot of the sort of Edward Snowden type revelations, quote unquote, whatever we think of the Snowden leaks, out of the bag, you know, a decade in advance to kind of prep the public consciousness. And I think that's, again, I think things like that are quite deliberate and can be seen by the active cooperation of the CIA with Hollywood. In fact, it goes well beyond just Hollywood and movies. It goes into every aspect of culture. I mean, there was a CIA program in the 1960s, I believe it was, to fund various pieces of avant-garde abstract art, and artists like Jackson Pollock, I believe, and people of that sort, promoting that overseas as a way of trying to undermine the Soviets in the Cold War. At least that's the excuse that they were operating on. And we've seen similar programs to try to spread, for example, accusations have been made of that type of involvement in the promotion of gangster hip hop. And that culture, which would actually, of course, line up with the destruction of the black community in the United States in the 1980s through the introduction of crack cocaine, which we now know, thanks to the reporting of people like Gary Webb, was coming via CIA channels. So, again, there's a lot of different ways that this comes in. But I think there's no question that pop culture, mass pop, popular entertainment has been infested for at least for half a century, if not more, demonstrably so, by these types of agencies that are, of course, that have everything to gain and nothing to lose by putting as much as pressure as they can on the entertainment culture industry to basically be in line with these types of ideas and goals and agendas. And we have to understand that fundamentally, I think all of this manipulation of news and the monetary system and all of this, I think fundamentally what this boils down to is an attempt to control the public consciousness. I think our mind is truly the ultimate prize of this. That's the ultimate battlefield where all of this is being waged, because there is no slave that is more enslaved in a system than one that cannot even see that they are enslaved in a system, one that willingly goes along with that system. And if you can get into people's mind and get them to go along with these agendas because they're just watching entertainment, they're just listening to music, whatever it is, but they're going along with a certain agenda, that is the most insidious way to wage warfare on a population.
I spoke to Joel Salatin this morning on an interview, and he brought up this cycle that civilizations go through, which I believe Voltaire wrote about. Joel's point was that it's a sign of the fragility and instability of a society how many laws and how much government meddling and how much manipulation. And that does ring true to me, that they have to do this stuff because the system is so fragile. If we were this robust, healthy, vigorous, self-sustaining culture, they wouldn't have to rig LIBOR. They wouldn't have to manipulate our social media and Hollywood films. And it seems like a sign of weakness more than anything. Do you agree?
Yes, there is an aspect to which this is weakness, but I wouldn't. I see what the way in which that's being framed, but I think also, unfortunately, I think that for the last century at least, demonstrably, there has been an incredible amount of work put into really understanding what makes people tick and using that against them. And this is, I mean, a well-studied science at this point was really pioneered by people like Walter Lippmann, writing things like Public Opinion, or Edward Bernays literally writing Propaganda, talking about how the public is the exact quote from Bernays's Propaganda is, "The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country." There in black and white in 1928, that was the type of thing that was openly discussed amongst these types of technocrats and social engineers, because it is absolutely demonstrably true in our own day and age that there is an unseen mechanism, an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of the country, that operates primarily through the manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses. And that is, in a way, I see what you mean by that being from a position of weakness, that they have to control people at that level in order to get them to go along with it. And if we merely become conscious of that fact and snap out of that conditioning, we can overcome really the century, at the very least, that they've put into manipulating culture and society in order to control it. We can overcome that simply by thinking through these manipulations and exposing them for what they are. Unfortunately, they are so vast, so deeply ingrained at this point, and so socially enforced, not by people in uniforms with badges necessarily, not with people in army boots with menacing guns, but by other people around us, the people who would call us conspiracy theories for even pointing out the existence of texts like Edward Bernays's 1928 Propaganda. And unfortunately, again, that is so effective and has been so effective for so long that it really has. I mean, the public has been subject to this type of manipulation for so long that it has become to the point where I think it's been so internalized that there's almost no resistance to it at all anymore. And I think that is changing because of programs like this one that we're doing right here, right now, and the fact that people are genuinely thirsty for this type of information. I think when the truth is presented to people in a cogent and coherent and well-sourced manner, that people will understand and will see it for the truth that it is. But it's a question of getting that in front of people's faces. And that's why I think in many ways, what's happening right now in alternative media on the internet is so important to the future of humanity. I mean, I think really at this point, we are facing a 21st century of total enslavement at the hands of a total global government that will totally manipulate and control the masses at a technological level, if nothing else, given the types of technologies that are coming into view, or a free humanity that will unshackle itself from the parasites, really, that have ensconced themselves at the top levels of that invisible government that Bernays wrote about 100 years ago. And I think the choice is ours. And it's this tiny window of opportunity that we have to actually become conscious of these manipulations and to stop falling for them. We have this moment of opportunity while there is still a modicum of free choice in our society. And a lot of that is rhetoric that is mouthed by politicians, and ultimately they want to enforce it at the barrel of a gun. But at least while that space still stands in our society, I think we have to be screaming from the top of our lungs in every way we can about these manipulations to wake up everyone that we can for what I think is coming to be the coming battle, not on a battlefield per se, but the battle for the minds of free humanity. And I think this is really where we stand today. I know that sounds very grandiose, but ultimately I don't see any other way around it. In the 21st century, I think humanity will either wake up, grow up, become the society that we've always been struggling to become, or we will be enslaved for the rest of eternity by the small ruling clique.
Yeah, I am constantly vacillating between. You once said, I listened to one of your podcasts, and you said that it was your nature to be optimistic. And it is mine too. And I see the silver lining in these clouds, even of collapse, that we'll learn to work together. We're going to come together. We're going to go local. And yet, I vacillate to the other side of that sine wave, in that I see global governance. You see, you know, we may live in our bubble where we understand these manipulations and what's going on behind the scenes, but I'm constantly surprised at people that I respect as intelligent and even informed, who will listen to 60 Minutes and think that they're this investigative journalist icon that tells the truth. And when I go out into the world outside of my little bubble, the vast, and I'm sure you're well aware of this, the vast majority of people have no idea even that the media is controlled, let alone that, you know, of Edward Bernays's, you know, propaganda strategies. And so I guess I vacillate between cynicism and a sense of impending doom, and hope and inspiration. Do you not do the same?
Well, of course, it's certainly not that this is going to be a straightforward process, let alone a process that's unmitigated with, you know, some sort of revolution that's unstoppable. I think it's certainly very much up in the air. You know, the extent to which the resistance is rising and the extent to which it is going to be capable of doing anything effective in actually stopping this agenda that we see unfolding. There's no point at which I've ever thought it was a foregone conclusion that we're going to win this battle. Having said that, I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that we're going to lose it. And if I did think that, I wouldn't be here talking to you or doing any of this work, really. So I think it is what we make of it, ultimately. And I can't control what anyone else is going to make of it. All I can do is do what I'm going to do to do my part to help spread the word. And I hope everyone else who is aware of these things will do their part as well. And ultimately, I think we have to let those chips fall where they may. But I think you're right that there is, I mean, so much of the sort of general public is not even clued into even the most basic facts of their political existence, their monetary existence in this world, that are just going along in their daily life to get along. And I don't even necessarily look down on that. I'm not in any sense feeling elite or superior to those types of people. They're simply trying to live their life. And I think ultimately that's what it boils down to. I'm just trying to live my life too. And if I could be one of those people who didn't care about politics or whatever and just went along and just lived my life and didn't have to worry about, you know, the next tyrannical move that was going to be made, I guess that would be a wonderful, that would be the ultimate goal, to be able to live in that society. Of course, I think you and I both know we don't live in that society yet, and that's why we're here doing what we do. But again, I think that in the vast sweep of human history, it's never been the vast majority of people who have swayed the direction of society one way or another. It's not the giant masses of people that, on the whole, are even that aware of what's going on. It's always a well-informed few who are on usually either side of the issue. And I think there are certainly well-informed technocrats on the side that want to manipulate and control and direct events. And then there are the well-informed few of us who are trying to fight against that agenda. And I think that's where the real battle for the minds of the public is happening, because ultimately the vast majority of people will go along through sort of cultural osmosis, whatever is the norms and standards of their society, whatever it is acceptable, socially acceptable to put forward. And if the debate can be steered so that talking about these things is conspiracy theory and that makes you crazy, then a lot of people simply won't ever listen to it because they don't want to be crazy. if we can flip that script and not talking about that is crazy, the majority of people who go along will just simply, again, maybe they're just puppeting things that they've heard, but they will go along with people who say whatever is the social norm. So I think it's really a battle between a much smaller segment of society, which is why I don't particularly get that disheartened when I notice that, yes, the vast majority of people that I interact with on a daily basis have no idea about most of this stuff going on. But again, I think that's not necessarily important to the fight that we're fighting.
I think a good example of the point that you just made about things being popular is sustainability and permaculture. And this is what I do for most of my life. I actually have an organic farm and I have this off-grid sustainability project, which was begun for completely different reasons. It was not to be a prepper whatsoever. It was to build a healing retreat and for personal reasons, to simplify my life and live a peaceful meditative existence. But I have been shocked to discover that in the face of everything that the government can do to make, and the corporate mindset to make things less sustainable or unsustainable, and this massive force, what actually has become quite trendy, to the tune that people come and volunteer from all over the world and work on our farm. It's not to say that they're not thoughtful people that are self-directed and just listening to the collective consciousness, but there is this collective consciousness that has opened up a dialogue and made people fascinated and intrigued and inspired by, you know, some simple concepts.
Yes, and unfortunately, I guess I'll be the other side of this particular sine wave. That is wonderful, and that is, I think, one of the signs that there is a true fundamental shift that's taking place in our society, hopefully, and hopefully that will be a snowball that will continue to roll down the hill and gather momentum. But on the other flip side of that, I think whenever there is that kind of genuine grassroots change that's taking place, unfortunately, again, the would-be social engineers are not stupid people, and they do see that coming. They do understand that it's very easy to manipulate that that impulse that people have. So that, for example, the idea of sustainability, the idea that we can live in sustaining communities that don't require all of this destruction of environmental resources and don't require reliance on multinational corporations to, you know, cradle to grave us mostly to the grave through their industrial farming practices and things of that sort. That is a wonderful thing. But unfortunately, there's the flip side of that. There's kind of the dark shadow that they roll out that, okay, you want
development.
Exactly. You want sustainability. Well, we'll give you Agenda 21 sustainable development. It will all be administered through the United Nations and it'll all be, oh, it's all for the globe and to keep everyone safe and happy. And we'll just control all the resources and create these wilderness corridors that you can't go into and limit and ration your resources based on, you know, how much carbon you're using and things of this sort. They will try to take over and basically hijack those cultural movements that are coming along just as part of the general cultural consciousness. So, you know, it's not an unmitigated good. It's something that we have to be aware of. And then on the flip side of that, when that happens and people realize, oh, the United Nations is trying to take this over through Agenda 21 and things like that, when people in the alternative media see that, then there's this unfortunate tendency against that to say, oh, then anything to do with sustainability is itself an evil UN agenda. No, that's not the point. The point is that the real idea here, which is truly important, has been hijacked and is being used. So people want to see it in a black and white way and just simplified like that. And unfortunately, it's always this three-dimensional chess that they're trying to play with your head. And unfortunately, again, if you don't even know you're in a chess game, you're probably going to lose it.
Right. Back to the economy, James. I'm, you know, I wanted to tell you that the first time I ever heard the word bankster, I was surfing YouTube, and it's when I found one of your really early podcasts back in your, I think it was your first year, and you had used the term bankster, and That just rang like a bell in my ear. It seemed so appropriate. And it really, listening to that one podcast really sent me in a direction of trying to understand, because the monetary system, as you know, is just so huge. It just, money, you know, not only makes the world spin around, but following the money tells you so much about what is going on in the world. And so I began following all the information I could get on the banksters and what was behind it and trying to understand and put the big picture together. And, you know, in that vein, I'm wondering what you think right now. I've been thinking for several years that we are on a precipice, but now we have the China market collapse. We have Greece, a European country that is essentially collapsing. We have China dumping U.S. treasuries. Russia has dumped the dollar. There seems to be even a greater, an acceleration. It's like cubed. It's not squared. And can it last much longer? And I'm not asking from a prediction from you, but what is going on in the economy, if you could paint a picture?
Well, you've outlined some of the general trends that, again, I don't think we have to be crystal ball gazing in order to understand the trends and where they're heading. And from a further perspective, we can understand perhaps why things are trending in that direction and thus what the ultimate end game of this is. And I think the ultimate end game, as long as we keep what the end game is, again, the on the record, not even controversial end game of this, is towards the creation of these regional currency blocks that will eventually be merged into a global monetary system that will ultimately replace the previous monetary system, which, of course, at the moment is the petrodollar, is this recycling of the U.S. dollars through the U.S. Wall Street banking houses as part of the exchange of oil throughout the world. And this is, of course, one of the reasons why we see every time one of the leaders talks about starting an oil burst of some sort that's not denominated in dollars, they end up getting bombed off the map. I don't think we have to, you know, scratch our heads too long trying to figure out why that is. So the entire monetary system, as we know it, is coming to an end. I think this has been very clearly detailed in the events of the last several weeks, where we see now, I mean, at least the official mainstream narrative is that the market turmoil we saw last week with Black Monday and all of that, well, that was China. It was because of the Chinese stock market. Now, ultimately, it's not because of China. It's because of the actions of the Federal Reserve and their central bank cronies creating all the liquidity in the markets over the last several years through the easing. And it's part of a much bigger story. But even that narrative that, oh, it's all China's fault, is part of this new normal that now, oh, okay, so the sort of locus of economic and geopolitical power is starting to move towards the East and starting to center around Beijing. And that's a narrative that we're being shown more and more in the news lately. And I think absolutely will continue to trend in that direction, as, for example, was admitted by Hillary Clinton back several years ago when she gave her Asia-Pacific pivot speech, where the United States is going to start playing more and more of a role in the Asia-Pacific. I think that wasn't just empty, idle threat. I think that's part of the long-term game plan. And I mean, a lot of people in the alternative media see this as, oh, these, you know, emerging economies are coming up to displace the Washington consensus status quo. And this is a great thing because we know, you know, NATO and the petrodollar has been enforced at the end of a barrel of a gun. So this will be a new era for geopolitical relations. I'm a much more cynical sort, so I really don't see it that way. And I look at the interlinkages between the very top of the financial pyramid in the United States and in the UK and in Israel and in China. At the very top, all of these financial interests tend to link up at one point or another. And yes, again, I think there are competing power blocks within this. I don't think it's an homogenous group, but unfortunately, there's a lot of cooperation that goes on at those highest levels. And I think at the end of the day, all of these various tendencies are towards the creation of regional power blocks, at the very least, the subsumption of national sovereignty into these regional groupings, whether it be a BRICS or a World Bank or a WTO or all of these various international organizations. And I think that is just a stepping stone towards the greater global governmental agenda, that even if people who are participating in these regional currency blocks and power blocks don't understand, that is where this is heading. That is the ultimate end of this dialectic that we're being placed into. So I think there's a much larger agenda towards the creation of these types of global governmental systems on the back of these regional systems that are coming into place. So when I look at something like China and the AIIB and the BRICS and these alternative counter organizations that are rising, it's interesting to me to see how they are rising within even things like the International Monetary Fund. So that, for example, we see China has been on the record angling for years now with the Chinese central bank governor for years, having advocated that the yuan should be placed in the IMF's special drawing rights basket, which is this kind of currency basket that it's a currency for central banks to use as part of their reserve holdings that can be redeemed in yen or dollars or pounds or euros. Well, the Chinese want the yuan to be included in that basket. So they are really trying to get more ensconced into the IMF framework and trying to become more of that organization, which will ultimately only serve to empower the IMF, of course, is the greater implication of this. But it's one that tends to get lost in the alternative media that sees, oh, the Chinese are rising. It's, you know, it's the displacement of the old evil American empire. Yay. Unfortunately, again, I don't think it's straightforward as that. So I think there's a much bigger trend that's developing here. And I think that's ultimately where this is going. I think we're going to see competing regional currency blocks, power blocks, political groupings that will ultimately lead towards a state where it will not necessarily look like global government in the way we might think of it as looking like global government, like a United Nations, except it with actual political power. I think it might be more of a system like, for example, when you look at the IMF special drawing rights, that is a currency that is only ever used by central banks. It is a reserve currency. It has nothing to do with, or we never see it. We never use it in our daily lives. Most 99.999% of the population has never even heard of it, let alone has any inkling of what it is or how it affects the global monetary order. And I think that's more likely the basis for a global government of the future. If there was a clear global government, it would be easier to at least identify and resist. But if it's this type of international institutional structure that takes place behind the scenes that doesn't affect your daily life, you're still buying your candy bar with your dollar bill. It's just you don't know that dollar bill is part of a currency basket that is administered by the International Monetary Fund that determines the value, so that your dollar bill suddenly turns into $10 bills that you need to buy a candy bar, and you have no idea why this is happening. That's the most insidious part. It's a battle that people don't even necessarily know is happening, let alone what side they should be on. So that's my view of the system they want to take us into. And all of that becomes a moot point if we continue to practice increase our practice in getting off of these systems. Instead of worrying about how these national currencies are being subsumed in these international currency baskets and things of that sort, if we are trading in local exchanges through local alternative currencies or through LETS programs or things of that nature, we can interact with each other without recourse to these greater systems of control. And that's, I think, the real weak point in this system. And that's why the decentralization of power is never on the table. It's always framed as in, well, do you want a national government or a regional government or a global government? Well, what if the answer is none of the above? You know, how do we check that box?
You know, I don't pretend to really fully comprehend how the powers that be think or work, but gleaning as much understanding as I have, it seems to me that I think Hillary Clinton said it. We can't let a good crisis go to waste. Isn't she the one that said that?
I believe that was Rahm Emanuel, but it's certainly been mouthed by many different people over the years.
Yeah, it was Rahm Emanuel is who I was thinking of. And I think that's the way they think. And, you know, this collapse, everybody's talking about, especially as China dumps their treasuries, you know, trillions of dollars, that all these dollars have to come home to roost and we have hyperinflation coming. It seems to me that the powers that be cannot allow the system to fail of its own accord. And my greatest fear is that they're going to pull the plug themselves, whether it's a another false flag, like 9/11, but on a bigger scale. I mean, you speak quite well and thoroughly on your research of global depopulation. And what a ripe time it would be, James, for them not only to, I mean, according to mainstream media, we're in recovery and everything is great, really. Obamacare saving people money, you know, all the Orwellian speak. What a great time, James, it would be to set off an EMP, create a big disaster of some kind, and then blame it all on, you know, Syria or whatever boogeyman, and also have global depopulation at the same time. My concern is something like that is, I don't know, probable, likely? What do you think?
From my perspective, and again, I can't really read the minds of the would-be controllers, but it makes perfect sense for them to use that as a way of forwarding their agenda, because it is so easy to do. If you are able to throw a culture into crisis and then proceed to offer your solution to that crisis, that is the best way to transform society. And this is, again, this isn't even something we have to speculate about. We can look at
Hegelian dialect.
Well, exactly right. And you can look, for example, the Rees Commission back in the 1950s, a congressional investigation into the tax-exempt foundations, had access to the Carnegie Endowment meeting minutes from 1908, where they were deliberating there at the Carnegie Endowment at its inception. The board members were deliberating throughout the course of 1908 on what is the best way to change society. And they decided, well, war. War is the best way to get people to change their minds. And whether that is necessarily a military war or economic war or whatever the form that may take, I think it continues to be. If you create a crisis, it's very easy to railroad people into a pre-presented solution to that crisis. And so it's exceptionally easy for would-be social engineers who have access to levers of power, like important positions in the State Department and in the military and in media and things of that, to shape crises into what they want. It's very easy to create a crisis, and then if you have those levers of power, very easy to steer society in the direction you want. The flip side of that is then, so what can we possibly do to counteract that? And the only thing is, we have to make it so that we are uncrisisizable, if that's a word that I can coin at the moment. If you can't be put into a position where it's easy to pull the rug out on you, then it's much easier to resist those types of societal changes. And again, that answer isn't going to come from looking to these regional groupings of, you know, nation states that we have no control over. It's going to come back down to the things that we actually control in our own lives. If we have control over the food that we're putting in our bodies and, you know, the way that we're interacting with people around us and transacting with them so that it can't be manipulated by currency manipulators in, you know, Wall Street or what have you. If we can, again, participate in these communities and build those communities up, then it's exceptionally difficult to create some sort of worldwide crisis if you have functioning, sustainable communities of people interacting and participating in that system. So I think ultimately the solution is going to be getting away from those systems of control, which puts us in that vulnerable position. And it's, I want to say easier said than done. In fact, it's probably easier done than said, because people don't want to even believe that. They want to believe, and I understand, it's very comforting to think that if you just put your trust in the right politician or in the right system, then everything will work out and you won't have to really do anything. You won't have to change your lifestyle. You won't have to put any effort into this. It'll just be, you know, effortless, that we'll never go into that type of tyranny that we're trying to resist. I think that's the case. I think it's something we have to work towards. It will be a difficult process. It will happen step by step. It certainly won't happen overnight, but we have to start making those steps now while we have the time and space to do it before that crisis can be generated.
I'm with you, brother. One last question. Those are some great answers. I love the way you frame the scenario that we're all in. I have a curiosity. One of my side pet subjects is free energy. And the cynical part of me really does believe that if it's really true that zero-point technology exists, or cold fusion, or some, you know, even really, really efficient technology that affords us, you know, much less expensive or self-generated energy, anything of that nature, I really do strongly suspect that it exists, but that it would never be allowed by the powers that be to rear its beautiful head and empower individuals. They don't want empowered individuals. But I have to say that my search is not exhaustive. Just recently I read about the Keshe Foundation. I won't go into it, but apparently Marin Keshe, an Iranian nuclear physicist, has come upon free energy. And I haven't seen any of your work encompassing that subject. What do you think goes on in that realm?
Well, I agree with you that any technology that even gets us closer towards energy independence, let alone free energy, I mean, anything that's even an improvement from what we have will be violently suppressed by the powers that shouldn't be, whether that's by physical violence or any other type of warfare, in order to suppress that knowledge and information, because that truly is one of the glaring weak points in the idea of trying to control a society. If a society is able to independently produce their own energy, I mean, that's a huge part of getting off the grid, literally. So absolutely, I think that's an exceptionally important thing for humanity. The problem with these types of zero point energy claims and things of that come along is that I've only been at this on the website for 8 years now, but I have seen several of these ideas come and go, being propounded by various people. Oh, this is it. I've found free energy. I can't show it to you. I can demonstrate it, but you can't see under the hood. I need to raise, X number of millions of dollars before I'll show it to anyone. That type of thing continues to come up, and it continues these people to continue to go by the wayside as they're exposed as frauds. I've seen that several times just in the 8 years I've been doing this, let alone however long people have been, looking for this type of zero point energy. So I'm exceptionally skeptical about this, because again, just as any actual information about how to really get off the energy control grid will be suppressed, I think it's also obvious that the social engineers would spend a lot of time and energy and resources planting false trails for people, trying to get people down rabbit holes, and trying to put out false fronts on this so that people won't ever actually make any progress on it. So my ultimate position on this is I'm going to be the ultimate skeptic on it. I'll believe it when I see it. When someone can present to me something that will power my household for, 100 years on a thimble full of water or whatever it is, awesome, great. Bring it on. Until that point, I really, there's so much disinformation out there. There's so much shadiness and counterpoints that it's one of those subjects that unless you really devote yourself to it completely and 100%, I think you're going to find a lot of distraction and disinformation and go down a lot of rabbit holes. So I have no doubt that there are technologies that exist out there that are more efficient than the ones that we have presented to us as the ways that we must organize our society. But finding the right one and promoting it is a different kettle of fish.
James, thank you for all the work that you do and for having this conversation and spreading the word of truth and just reason, if nothing else. Sometimes I think the world has abandoned reason. I'm really in gratitude for your efforts.
Well, thank you very much. And I am in solidarity with you and everyone else who's trying their best to spread this information to others. I think that's truly one of the most important things we can be doing at this stage, because again, it's about a battle for our hearts and minds, as they like to say, and I think they're right about it. It is about the battle for the hearts and minds. So let's get this information out and let's start changing the conversation away from what they want us to talk about and towards what we can actually do to empower ourselves.
Next episode, we'll address the Kardashians.
Yes, of course.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you. That you bought today.